later in life?
In general, yes. I would say that most of the chronic, the ones I've listed, begin later in life. They can begin early in life, depending on the genetic components that are made up of that. For example, Huntington's disease is a genetic disease which can occur earlier in life.
Have you ever been a reviewer for the National Institutes of Health?
Oh, yeah. I served on a study section for 5 years.
And study section is... It's the group of academics and researchers who review grant applications, correct?
Correct, yeah. So when I submit, the same happens to me. It's like peer review of a manuscript, only it's peer review of a grant.
And do study sections have particular focuses? You know, is your study section based on your area of expertise?
Yeah, my study section was titled Neurotoxicology and Alcohol. So it basically dealt with neurological effects of alcohol in the brain as well as neurotoxicology.
Now, when you review grant applications for your study section, are decisions based on the scientific validity of the proposed study or potential political policy considerations?
We don't consider politics or political considerations. The reviews, and specifically, I can comment on this in response to something that Dr. Deeth was saying in his testimony. I actually, our study section actually reviewed a Deeth grant in 2003, and my recollection of that grant review was that it was a weak hypothesis, preliminary data didn't support it, and there was not a good experimental design set up in the grant. And so the reason that grants and study section don't get funded or get rejected or get low scores is not due to the politics. It's due to the scientific merit of the application, absolutely.
Now, in your review of Dr. Deeth's expert report, you identified a number of concerns. I wanted to just talk about a few of them here. I think we're switching to slide 2 now. In general, did you encounter instances where Dr. Deeth used in vitro laboratory work to extrapolate to the in vivo situation?
Yeah, and in his expert report, he did that, I think, over and over.
Now, are there complications that can arise from in vitro studies?
There's complications and there's dramatic limitations. I mean, in vitro studies are in vitro studies. And, I mean, I tell the people in my laboratory and postdocs and grad students, if you're working with a cell line, the interpretations that you can make on the data that you generate in that cell line has to be held within that cell line. I mean, you can form hypotheses based on maybe what you get from the cell line, but you can't extrapolate that data without actually doing the experiments.
Now, are there protective mechanisms that happen in vivo that are not present in vitro?
Once you take out the cell and put it into an environment that's not natural, a lot of things change. And so, you're changing all kinds of aspects of that. So you don't have the cell-cell communication anymore, and you also are looking at different things that are occurring in the cell. So all things are completely different. You can't even compare it.
And particular cells used sometimes have an effect. This is slide 3.
Yeah, and I put this slide up to try to, again, to help clarify what a cell line is and how we look at a cell line. And so a neuroblastoma cell line is basically a self-renewing cell line that grows spontaneously. They're usually from tumors. They often have aberrant numbers of chromosomes. They don't have the normal number of chromosomes. They also contain, in a number of situations, multiple genetic mutations because of the way that the tumors are growing. And self-renewing cells tend to have mutations that they carry through. Again, as I mentioned already, they're constantly expanding and dividing. And they have uncontrolled growth. If you transplant them into mice, they form tumors. And in most situations, especially when we're talking about neuroblastoma cells, and I think this is a real critical point, is that we get what we call a dedifferentiation. So, for example, the neuroblastoma cells that are being used in most of these studies is they also have characteristics of glial cells. So they don't have just the neuronal proteins in them anymore. They also express glial proteins and they have glial characteristics, and you can see all these other kinds of things. So they almost take a step back away from this differentiated state that we see in vivo to more of a primordial state where they have different proteins turned on that are not normally there in neurons. And that's a major, I think, a major issue that people need to understand is these are not like neurons, differentiated neurons. The reason they're used is because they're easy to use and they're cheap. And so you can do a lot of experiments, fast in them. But you do have to remember that their interpretation is almost it's impossible to extrapolate to humans. The other system that I want to talk about briefly in vitro was this primary neuronal cultures. And in this situation, they're very different.
Can you say it again? The what?
Primary neuronal cultures. They're very different because what you do in that situation is you remove the brains from mice and you're able to dissociate and plate them out in a dish. But they are terminal, basically. They differentiate like you would in vivo. They have the character. So if you look at the culture, they have markers of glial cells in the glial culture, and the neurons don't have those glial markers and so on. And so they do maintain, quote, a little more of their phenotype in that kind of context. And so the next step to what you would, at least what we've done, is if you find something in a blastoma cell or a cell line, we instantly move it into a primary culture system because it's more representative of what's the in vivo situation is. Again, because it's not in the context of the brain, its extrapolation is limited. Okay, you can't just say what's happening there will happen in vivo. But at least they're normal cells, although they may not be in this context of the brain, but they do have normal phenotypes. And so they're a better thing to use in a dish than a cell line, for sure. They give you a little bit more insight, and they maintain much more of the normal function of the individual cells you're trying to study.
Now, on page 3 of his report, in the second full paragraph, Dr. Deeth states that thimerosal is toxic to human cortical neurons and neuronal cells grown in culture. Is it okay if I just generally describe where that is? Do you need me to give you a more pinpoint identification of the location?
No, that's fine.
Okay. And he cites to 3 references, which I believe are Herdman, Baskin, and Perrin.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Were these in vitro studies?
Yes, they were.
And what types of cells were used in these experiments?
Cell lines. They were the neuroblastoma cell lines, and they were not the primary cultures.
My main reason bothers
me because when people talk about cell lines and they use the word neuronal, that infers to people that are looking at it or that are reading it that it's actually neurons, and they are not. And so there is a distinct misrepresentation of using that kind of terminology, cortical neurons or neuronal, when you're looking at neural cell lines. And again, if a student gives me a paper that they're working on and they use the word neuronal and they don't use the word neuroblastoma, it's changed. It's wrong. It's just a misrepresentation. It's misleading to say that. So.
And were the doses used in these studies similar to what's used in vaccinations?
Oh, no. If you based on the couple papers that have looked in mouse and primate this mimicking this vaccination schedule, the Berman paper and then the Burbacher paper, but I looked at those papers just to kind of get a dose of what would be in the brain.
And let me be clear, I'm not asking you to go into specific toxicology of mercury, because that's not
my area. No,
I'm
just
talking about.
Well, all I did was look at those to say, okay, here's what they're saying is a dose or a level in the brains of these animals. And it's in the, as it's been presented before, that's in the nanomolar range. And so when I looked at the papers, then of course they were micromolar range. And so that to me said that they were much, much higher than what would be at least in those 2 studies.
Now, Dr. Deeth also cites a paper by Maddie Hornig in support of his arguments, correct?
Yes.
I believe that's PML15. Now, you mentioned that the mouse strain Dr. Hornig, this is in your expert report, that the strain Dr. Hornig used was selected because it had a stronger immune response.
Right.
But took issue with Dr. Deeth's explanation of the rationale behind the use of the strain, correct?
Right.
And I believe he stated that hers was a mouse strain harboring genetic deficits in redox-related enzymes. And this is from page 4. It's the first sentence of the paragraph preceding the bolded effects of methylation.
Yeah.
What strain of mouse was used?
It was an SJLJ mouse. And the interpretation of that, or the way that was written by Dr. Deeth in his report, was inferring that there is a redox enzyme differential or some kind of differential. And that's absolutely not true. And, I mean, the mice have this increased immune response, and that's why the mice were selected, and they've been used in these studies a lot by other groups. So there is absolutely no data supporting the fact that there is a redox enzyme differential. Now, I can understand the reason it's in there is because it supports his hypothesis in the sensitivity, but that's not an accurate representation of the mice.
And in general, do you have confidence in Dr. Hornig's reported results? And here, actually, we're switching to slide 4, and I apologize, we inadvertently switched slide 4 and slide 5, so really what we mean to be switching to is what is marked in the trial exhibit as slide 5.
What were you repeating?
If you have confidence in Dr. Hornig's reported results.
No.
Part of that has to do with the hippocampal sections.
Correct? Yeah, I mean, the quality, I mean, and I can point, I don't know if I can point this out, but if you look at these images on the right side of this slide,
they are the sections from the
these
Horning
are from
paper.
The Horning paper. These are the vehicle, and this is the thimerosal treated mouse. To be quite honest,
which ones were you referring to when you said
the upper right and the lower right are the two images from the Horning paper. The A is the vehicle, and the B is the thimerosal.
And what do you mean by vehicle? Just to
vehicle in this case, they were dissolving the vaccine that they were giving in. So okay. it's basically the same solution, same volume, without the vaccination, without the thimerosal in it. Okay. And what you can see when you look at these images is these images are absolutely awful. Now, the staining here is hematoxylin and eosin, and it's supposed to stain for architecture and cell integrity and a variety of other things. And the tissues are very diffuse. There's not clear neural fields right here. They're weak staining.
You're pointing to the top slide.
Yeah, top slide. If you look at those images, right, the cells that are dark right there, those are the neuronal fields. And the quality is just extremely low. So, I mean, I
could... I'm not sure what you mean. The quality of the photography is low?
No, the quality of the sections themselves is very low. And I'll talk in the next slide. I'll specifically talk about what I think, you know. Let's put it this way. I've seen this in my lab before. I've seen people come to me with images like this or with sections and stained like this. And I'll say, something's wrong, okay? The tissue wasn't prepared right. There's something that's definitely wrong with this because these do not maintain the nice cellular architecture that you should see if the experiment's done right and the tissue's harvested correctly.
So it's fair to say that problems with these slides and these sections caused you to question the ultimate findings of the
paper. Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And has a recent paper, in fact, refuted Dr. Hornig's findings?
Yeah, we've talked about the Berman paper. That's come up in the Berman paper. These sections on the left side of the slide, the upper and lower sections, are comparable sections from the Berman paper. And they're absolutely beautiful. When you look at the cellular architecture and the structure of the hippocampus, which is this region, the cells look very nice. The stain is different. That's a crystal violet, but that wouldn't make any difference. You're still looking at the cell structure, the cell architecture, and the way that the tissue was prepared, and it looks very, 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 very good.
Now, strictly discussing dose, what dose of thimerosal was used in the Dr. Berman's paper?
Well, Dr. Berman did the same dose as that was used in the Horning study, but then they also did a dose that was 10 times higher. And in both situations, there was absolutely no pathological outcome with regard to the dosing with thimerosal.
And did both papers use antibodies on brain tissues?
Yes, and this adds another factor that I wanted to point out.
And
yes, they stain with antibodies. So antibodies now, what antibodies do is they stain specific proteins in the tissue sections. And what I want to point out here is there the distinct difference between the Berman paper sections and the Horning paper sections using the same antibody. Now, this is exactly the same staining and same antibody.
Now, we're moving back to slide 4.
Back to slide 4, right.
What was, originally identified as slide 4. I apologize.
So, again, what I want to point out is if you look at the architecture of the tissue, it's really nice in the Berman study. And you see this nice staining in the hippocampus, which is validated, which has basically been shown in many, many other papers prior to this type of staining where you see...
If I can stop you for a moment. I'm sorry. I think we need to clarify.
Dr. Johnson, I'm going to be listening to
but you can't see. Okay.
Reading your testimony again, and I'm not going to be able to see where you're pointing. So you have to tell me.
Right. So the Berman sections are the two panels on the left side of the slide, here and here. And then the comparable little boxes in those panels on the left side are enhanced on the lower portion of the right side of the slide. So these little squares are put down here.
And this is the bottom right hand.
At the bottom right hand corner.
Two bottom panels.
The two bottom panels. Again, they're labeled vehicle and thimerosal plus vaccine. And what you can see is there's very nice staining in the field, and the neuronal field, which are the neurons, the clear layer that goes in through that section, those are the neurons, and they are not staining intensely, but the cells around that field are staining very intensely. And again, that's been published multiple times by other groups, that pattern. Now, if you look at the upper four panels on the right side, these are the similar comparable panels from the Horning study. And the first thing that I want to point out is if you look at the tissue, it's full of holes. So if you look at this enhanced image right here, the bottom two panels, C and D, from the Horning study, you can see that the tissue almost looks like it's disintegrating. It's breaking down. There's holes all over in the tissue. Now, I know from experience that when you see tissue like this, the amount of nonspecific staining with antibodies could be intense. So the staining, basically, if somebody came to me with this kind of staining or this kind of tissue in my laboratory, I would say go back and do the whole experiment again, because these are unpublishable to me, and two, the potential for artifactual data generated from this kind of degenerated tissue is extremely high. And so they would need to go back and redo these studies to ensure that they were doing the tissue preparation correctly. And this is very important, especially when you're trying to do histological section and making conclusions from histological data like this. You know, you can do whatever you want after you have the tissue, but it's the process of getting the tissue to the point where the tissue quality is extremely good. Then you can make the correct interpretations. And in this situation, I don't see that.
And is it fair to say that you do see that in the Berman tissue quality?
Oh, yeah. The Berman tissues look absolutely perfect. It looks like their preparation is done extremely well, and the sections are beautiful.
And as a result, do you place more weight on the Berman findings?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now, Dr. Deeth also relies heavily on the 2004 Wally paper, which has already been the topic of some of our expert testimony,
right?
PML-257. Do you also share concerns about this paper?
Yeah.
And what are dose curves and how are they important here?
Well, dose curves are critical to understand the differential sensitivity of different toxins that you're actually using. So you have to run dose curves to make sure that you're running in the range where you're seeing the effects that you want. And if you're trying to compare between different toxicants, I mean, you have to have dose curves so that you know the differential sensitivity of the toxicants with regard to what you're measuring.
And Dr. Deeth, did he use dose curves?
No, he did not.
And what type of methionine synthase was being measured, and how is that significant? And this is slide 6.
And this is the slide 15. The type of methionine synthase in the SHSY5Y cells is actually a mutated form of methionine synthase that lacks this blue domain in the upper left-hand corner of the slide, as he pointed out.
And you're circling the area with the X.
Yeah, with the X through it. And this goes back to the point of cell lines. I mean, cell lines are not normal. So if you look in normal cells and normal neurons and normal astrocytes, you don't see this form of methionine synthase. This methionine synthase is a result of this tumor transformed cell line that's being used in these studies. Now how that affects the interpretation of the methionine synthase data, remains to be determined. But clearly, you can't assume that the data that's generated with regard to methionine synthase in the cell line is going to represent what's going on even in the dish with a normal neuron, because the protein's different.
Now, how is the reported MAP3 kinase and PI3 kinase inhibition significant? And why do you doubt the results reported in the Wally paper?
Well, it's... And Dr. Millman talked about this quite a bit too, and is that there are a lot of things that you can do. For example, what was used in the paper were chemical inhibitors. But chemical inhibitors are not specific, they're selective. And by that I mean is that they can inhibit lots of different things at different doses if you're not careful with how they're used. So in t- today, in this age, when we have a variety of other new novel techniques where we can selectively target and knock out specific proteins. So, for example, in addition to using a chemical inhibitor, we often use a technology called siRNA technology, where you can say, okay, ERK1, or this one protein, this one kinase, is we think is doing this. We have an inhibitor, but it inhibits like 10 kinases. We want to just see if that one, okay, is if we can inhibit that one or take that one out of the cell, do we block our path? Do we block what's going on? And so what you can do is you can actually do that with these new technologies. You can go in and selectively target specific proteins and get rid of them in the cell, and then come back and show that the effect is driven, or the effect that you're looking for is gone or eliminated. And so good quality papers really combine almost at least two, if not three, different kinds of techniques, and they use the pharmacological inhibitors as long as molecular approaches to validate everything so it all fits together. And in cell lines, that's very easy to do. Cell lines are very conducive or very accepting of these kinds of techniques. And so without those kinds of validations, it's very difficult to make conclusions on the specific kinases that might be involved in the pathway.
Now, I wanted to move on to a discussion about some of the unpublished data. Now, Dr. Deeth in his report cited to a manuscript in preparation, correct?
Right.
I believe, for the record, that's reference number 24, which he specifically cites at the bottom of the first paragraph on page 5. Have we ever seen a copy? Has a copy ever been provided to you or to the court, to your knowledge?
No.
But Dr. Deeth does discuss this unpublished work in his expert report.
Yes.
Setting aside for a moment the fact that it is unpublished, do the numbers discussed in his report raise questions when compared to other research involving thimerosal?
Yeah,
generally in your review.
Right. The doses that are presented in the report are implying that there are low nanomolar doses that are doing or generating the effects that Dr. Deeth is saying. And in almost all of the other literature, in fact, even in other people using the same cells that Dr. Deeth uses, they're showing effects in the micromolar range. My comment on that, I think, is that a cell line is used for a number of reasons, and in this case, the SHSY5Y cell line is used. This cell line is available commercially from a company called ATCC, who banks these cells. And so one of the nice things about a cell line, if there are 10 investigators across the country and they all order the cell line from this company and they grow it in their incubators, then the theory is, or at least what we find is that there can be consistency between the different labs. So if you treat the cells the same way with drugs or whatever, you see relatively consistent results between the different groups and the different labs that are doing this. And, there can be some variation between groups, whether the cells are in California or, New York, they could have different, environmental exposures or air, they have different air concentrations and stuff like that. But in general, we could maybe attribute that to very small different, changes, maybe 4 or 5, maybe tenfold at the most differentials in sensitivity, but 2-3 orders of magnitude. I can't understand how that would happen outside of just some technical kind of differences, or if they're really, really, the cells are really, really sick.
So the reported results are substantially lower, 100 to 1,000 times?
Yes, and it's the only report that shows that.
Any indication that this has been peer-reviewed or tested?
No.
Now, Dr. Deeth also discussed quite a bit of unpublished data in his presentation last week. You've just sort of talked about some of the general issues you have with, some of the unpublished data we've seen as it related to Deeth reference number 24. My next question sort of relate generally to that and also what he presented in his testimony. The data that he presented last week as well, in addition to reference 24, has any indication that that's ever been peer-reviewed?
No.
Not published?
No.
Tested?
No.
We just don't know?
No, we just don't know.
Now, were you present during the testimony?
Yes, I was.
You've had an opportunity to review the slide presentation. Obviously, you've incorporated some here already. And now I know you wanted to comment on slide 17.
Yeah.
Which is slide number 7 in your presentation.
Yeah. Slide.
Why did Dr. Deeth discuss this slide?
Well, I think what Dr. Deeth was trying to say here was that the levels of cystathionine and his pathways on the next page, and I'll show you that briefly, were markedly higher in the human cortex than in other species. This slide looks at the human brain and a variety of other animals, including...
Switch quickly to slide 8.
Including duck. And so what he used this data to do was to justify this statement here that the increase in...
Which statement?
The statement in the middle that's highlighted in the light green.
And blue. He's,
or blue or whatever. I'm not colorblind, but I just don't know colors. So my daughter would be able to tell me that's aqua something something. You know.
I'm sure we could come up with at least five names of what that color could be, but call it light blue.
So he's using that to justify this statement that the conversion of cystathionine to cysteine is compromised. And again, here's the word neuronal cells. That's not true. This is SHSY5Y cells. And basically, that's impossible to conclude because there's no measurement of cysteine or there's no measurement of glutathione. Maybe the human brain just has more of the cystathionine, but they actually maybe have more of the cysteine and the glutathione as well. And without knowing that, you can't make any conclusion that there's a partial dysfunction in that pathway. In fact, if you look at human tissues and you look at mouse tissues and you look at these other tissues, except for duck, I've never looked at duck, The glutathione levels in the brains of these animals are not different. They range, but they're certainly within a very close window of concentration. And the duck thing, I kept thinking about the duck.
Well, that actually, let me get you there.
Give me the duck.
Was there a citation to the source of this data?
No, actually, Dr. Deeth had no citation. And when I walked away from this, I assumed that he had generated this data himself. And like I said, the duck kept bothering me, and I kept thinking about this. And so what I did in this day and age is we Google. So I Googled duck and cystathionine, and the top hit was a paper published in 1958 by Harris et al., who actually measured cystathionine levels in duck. And what I was really surprised to see was that the data that Dr. Deeth presented was basically the same table that was published in 1958, but he didn't reference it.
Scientifically, do you have a problem with this?
I have a major problem with this because as scientists, we reference what we, if we're taught using somebody else's work, we reference it. And this brings into question, I mean, you know, the scientific integrity of somebody that's going to be, you know, taking somebody else's data and using it, but not actually giving them giving the reference of where they received it, where they got it from.
Now, did you also review Dr. Jeet's slides 24 and 28, also the unpublished data?
Yeah, this was also the unpublished data. Yes, I did.
What would your concerns be as someone who looked over this?
Well, again, you know, I looked at these slides.
Slide 10.
When they were presented in the slide 24 and slide 28, and the image that's up here from slide 28 is just looking at the glutathione component, which is part F of that and the whole slide, and the one of the things that jumped out at me right away when I saw these slides is the concentration of glutathione. So the basal level of glutathione that he shows in the panel on the left, slide 24, just at the zero point on the curve, is 700 nanomoles per milligram protein in the SHSY5Y cells. And then in slide 28, it's the same cells, and here the nanomole per milligram protein of glutathione is over 1,500. And I thought this was extremely high based on my experience. And so I went into the literature and I actually looked at about 10 papers that used SHSY5Y cells and measured glutathione in the same units, nanomoles per milligram protein. And it turns out that all 10 of those papers, the basal glutathione in the SHSY5Y cells is between 12 and 30 nanomoles per milligram protein. So again, this could be a calculation error or misrepresentation. It's not an intentional misrepresentation, but it goes to the point that this data was not carefully evaluated as far as the units and the numbers that were used. And again, it just has a careless nature about it, because if you know the literature and you understand the glutathione concentrations in the cells, you would have noticed that these numbers are extremely high and far off base.
Now, moving on to slide 11, I know you had a comment about, you know, glutathione measurement and time.
Yeah, this again is another instance of, you know, basically picking the time that you want to show your effect. And in all of Dr. D's studies in the previous slides, the time after the treatment was 1 hour. So he's looking at a very, very acute depletion of glutathione in these cells. And we have experience, and a number of other labs have shown that if you actually deplete glutathione in a cell, like in a cell line like this, and you get it significantly, like maybe down to 70 or 80%, what happens is the cell senses that the glutathione is reduced, and the cell compensates. So it changes, and what it does is it actually makes the proteins and the enzymes that synthesize glutathione. And if you look at those same cells that were 80% depleted at 4 hours, as shown in the slide in the lower right hypothetical data set, if you look at those same cells at 24 and 48 hours, you may actually have two or three times the level of glutathione in those cells. And those cells would actually be more resistant to toxicity if you actually, at that point, put a toxin on. So it's a dose and it's a time issue. And you really have to run the full spectrum, I think, of both dose and time to make the right kinds of interpretations about this data. And so what this really is showing here, describing, is what we call almost like a preconditioning response. So a little bit of stress is good, because a little bit of stress causes you to have this compensatory mechanism that then makes you more resistant to more stress. Okay, and so this is a very important concept in toxicology and preconditioning response and the way that cells respond to these kinds of issues.
Now, what is carbon-14 labeled THF?
Carbon-14 labeled tetrahydrofolate. So I don't want to make this complicated. This is more of a question, I think, and I didn't quite understand this, but I wanted to understand the methionine synthase assay. You know, Dr. D spent a lot of time talking about methionine synthase. So methionine synthase is this enzyme that he says that's inhibited, and he has an assay that he uses to measure this. I want you to understand this assay, okay? So I'm not going to try to be very complicated with this. I'm going to be very straight. So if you look at this slide, look at the red, okay? So the red in the upper right hand, the CH3, okay, that's the radio label. So that's in the end.
What?
Radio label, radioactive. So in the end, this is what you measure. So that thing, that red CH3 has to be on the methionine at that point so that you can actually put it into a machine and the machine tells you how much radioactivity is there. Okay?
And the amount of radioactivity would tell you how much
activity the enzyme has.
Okay.
Right. And so I went back and found a methods and enzymology paper that actually uses this assay. And the way that this is done is you have this methyl group that's radioactive, so you can measure the enzyme. But what happens is this tetrahydrofolate donates this to the hydroxy B12. So then what happens is this B12 carries that label, okay? Then that label is transferred to methionine by methionine synthase. And so in the end of this experiment, what you have is you have this radio-labeled red thing that moves through this assay and ends up on what you want to measure and gives you some measure of enzymatic activity. Now, when you go to the next slide, and we'll go to the next slide and we want to come back. But when you go to the next slide, what you're seeing here is, and this is the slide 28, and it's my slide 13, is you'll see that there's hydroxy B12, which is referred to as in the blue lines in all these graphs, or no, is the yeah, no, is in the red lines of all these graphs. Jeez, I'm getting better glasses, and then we have the methyl B12, which is the blue lines in all these graphs. Now, the question I have is if you're adding methyl B12, so if you can go back to the other slide, if you're adding this to the assay, which goes right to here. With this, but this doesn't, if the methyl B12 doesn't have the radioactivity on it that you put into the assay, how can you measure enzymatic activity? You can't. Because this is going to be sitting there. You're going to have tons of this around that doesn't have the label on it, and all this unlabeled stuff is going to be running, going into the assay.
Doctor, I'm going to ask you to run back through that again.
Okay.
Instead of saying this and pointing, okay, tell us what it is.
So this, the methyl B12 that's shown here, that's radioactive.
Okay. And when you say here, you're referring to the CH3B12 on the left side.
The CH3B12 in this assay, in this case, when you're looking at this diagram, the way the assay is run is ends up transferring that radio label to the CH3 methionine, and you can measure that. But if you're adding CH3B12 where the CH3 is not radioactive, you basically can't measure the methionine synthase activity because you get a CH3 methionine that doesn't have any radio label on it. So I can't, this goes back to peer, this is why peer review is important, because we don't know what he did. We don't know what the assay was. We don't know how this works. And then if you flip to the next slide, it shows that all of the assays where you use this methyl B12, they're all higher than they are with the conventional assay. And so I just can't figure it out. And this, again, the reason I do this is because I want to point out this is the kind of thing that a peer review would actually want addressed. They'd want to know how this was done. We need to see the methods and so on. And so I don't want to do this to confuse you, but I'm trying to just make the point that these are the kinds of issues with unpublished data and a lack of peer review. So it gets, I spent a lot of time looking at this and it got me really frustrated.
Now, slide 34 was more unpublished data involving an experiment with PCR. This is PCR, a technique your laboratory uses.
Yes, we do quantitative PCR all the time.
And as I think the court indicated yesterday, and I'm also acutely aware, we're somewhat informed on the issue of PCR already, so we're not going to go into a big description of that. But just generally, looking at a PCR assay like this, what sort of concerns or questions would you need to have answered in order to place any scientific weight on this?
Well, first off, I mean, there's no indication of how many samples were analyzed. We don't know how the assay was run. I mean, was there equal amount of RNA used in the assay? How is the assay standardized? Conventionally, when we standardize a PCR reaction, we actually do a housekeeping gene or another gene that's not going to change, so you can actually control for that to make sure.
Let me stop you and go back because
I'm
not following on this at all. First of all, we're on your slide 14.
Yeah, and we're talking about slide 24.
And yes,
34.
And we're talking about.
34. Sorry. My fault. Go ahead.
We're talking about the deep slide 34, and that is a result. Deep slide 34, refresh my memory. That is one of his, another one of his slide describing his original research of the last year.
Right, the one that he didn't, yes. That was one that
not
he
yet been
it's published. Unpublished, right.
And slide 34 describes what? Tell us what it described before you.
So slide 34 describes is there. It's describing the loss of methionine synthase expression or the loss of RNA in autistic patients versus control patients. So what the data is showing is that
it describes a test that he did.
Yes, it shows the results of a test that he did. That in autistic patients, this enzyme, this methionine synthase enzyme expression, is significantly lower in autistic patients than in control patients. The problem with the data is that there's no indication of how the data was standardized. The RNA quality is a major problem. I mean, if there's any RNA breakdown in the samples before you run this assay, it can completely mess up what you're trying to interpret. And the reason I brought this up is because we have tried for a long time to get reliable RNA to do PCR from Down syndrome patients, postmortem kind of tissue, and we have had an impossible time to get a good yield of high-quality RNA to the point that we feel comfortable actually running the PCR at all. We haven't even been able to get RNA that we think we're able to run in the assay. And so without having RNA gels and RNA analysis to find out if the RNA is good to begin with, you can't even run these assays. And so the reason I I thought this was important is it is this is a this is a finding that needs to be you need to see we need to see in a peer review situation that the RNA preparations and that all the stuff that's that you need to get before you even do this is of good quality, and none of that is indicated in here. So that's why I wanted to make sure that I pointed this out.
All right, go ahead.
Now, as we've already heard this week, good scientific method involves hypothesis generation and then an effort to try and disprove a hypothesis via testing to see if you can replicate or validate the results, correct?
Correct.
Is there any indication that Dr. Dietz's unpublished data has undergone this process?
No, and in fact, it would appear more likely that what Dr. Dietz's preliminary data is doing is trying to prove his hypothesis. And we had a nice talk from Dr. Mailman yesterday about this. And I'll tell you, the first thing I do when I get a new grad student or postdoc in my lab, and they come into my office and they sit down in front of me and I say, what's your hypothesis? What are you trying to test? And they'll say, well, I think this is the hypothesis and this is the results. I think that, you know, this is the results that I think we should get. And I look right at them and I said, what I want you to do is I want you to think about this. I want you to think about the hypothesis. I know there are 100 experiments that you could do that you could try to prove this. But what I want you to do is I want you to think of the easiest, the most straightforward, and the simplest experiment that if it didn't work would refute your hypothesis and defeat it. Okay? And do that one first. Because you could spend 4 years of your graduate school, you know, working to try to prove your hypothesis and then do that experiment at the end and the whole thing goes up in smoke. We don't want that. What we want is we want this to be critical from the very beginning, and for the exact same reasons that Dr. Mailman explained, this is a critical experiment. Even to the point if the data is, you know, if the data is so important, we'll actually ask other people in other labs to try to validate that data even before we publish it.
And there's no indication that other labs have been able to validate this, correct?
No.
Do we have any information about the known or potential rate of error with this research?
It could be huge. I mean, we don't know.
And based on your knowledge of this area in scientific literature, is there any indication that this hypothesis is accepted by the general medical or scientific community?
No.
And the idea that TCVs could have a role in autism isn't a new or novel one, is it?
No, it's been around since 2000.
Now, were you here for the testimony of Dr. Kinsborn last week?
I was here, for the direct and part of the cross.
And as a neurotoxicologist, does some of your laboratory work involve the same mechanisms in the brain that Dr. Kinsborn discusses?
Yes.
Now, as I understand it, Dr. Kinsborn posits a theory that in part relies on astrocytes dying or malfunctioning, unable to properly fulfill their role in the brain.
Yes, that's in general what he was saying, yes.
Now, did you understand Dr. Kinsborn to be saying that his model of causation was resulting in neuronal death?
No.
And can activation of microglia actually be beneficial?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there are a number of situations where microglial activation can be beneficial. This, again, is one of these areas where, you know, sitting in the court and listening to these conversations has been a bit frustrating because I think it's been an oversimplified process. I think we need what I'd like to do if I could would be to step back and so when I teach, I try to involve my class in doing things, and so there's really three cells involved here. It's the astrocyte, the neuron, and the microglia. At least that's what we've been talking about. And so Special Master Campbell Smith, you'll be an astrocyte. Special Master Hastings, you'll be a neuron. And you get to be the microglia. And so
macrophages.
So in a normal state, the three of you are existing in perfect harmony. And, you know, you're functioning fine, and you, actually, your role is to be a kind of this barrier between Special Master Vowell and Special Master Hastings, at least between the microglia and the neuron. So the astrocyte is actually, in my context, the astrocyte is actually a very positive component in the brain that maintains kind of this dynamic and communicates with both the microglia and the neuron and tries to maintain this homeostatic state. So in in the context of what we've been talking about with the bad effects of microglia, what happens and is, for example, the astrocyte in this situation would fall asleep during my testimony, which I hope doesn't happen, be dysfunctional, and that would allow the microglia to jump on and kill the neuron. And not that that would happen either in the courtroom, but, you know, we're trying. So in that case, it would be a negative effect. And that's kind of what we've been talking about this whole time. Now, on the other situation, there are times and examples, both in vivo, where you, as a neuron, would be damaged. And the ability to repair your damage is not dependent upon the astrocyte, but is actually dependent upon the microglia. So the microglia and the activation of the microglia in that damage situation is actually very important for you to become back to a normally functioning neuron. And so we need to understand that neuroinflammation as a term is not astroglia and microglia. It's really a combination of the microglia and the astroglia and how they communicate with each other, and how you are suppressing the negative effects and you're able to, as a microglia, have positive effects in the brain too. So microglia are not always negative. They're positive. They can be negative in certain kinds of contexts as well. But it's a very dynamic system, and you can't just generalize by saying specific things. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. That's okay.
Sorry.
I don't want to.
Do microglia release both pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory agents?
Yes.
Now, moving on to proliferation of astrocytes. Is this what's known as gliosis?
Yes, it's a gliosis.
Now, Dr. Kinsborn mentioned that glial scars are formed from astrocytes dying. Do you agree?
No, I do not agree with that. Glial scarring actually is a result of activated astrocytes moving into the region of damage and actually secreting proteins that lay down a matrices that forms the scar. But astrocytes in and of themselves aren't dying to form the scar. That's, again, I think a misrepresentation. And I talk to colleagues about this that do this work, and they completely agree with that, is that the astrocytes in a glial scar are not dying to form the glial scar. What they're doing is they're secreting factors and proteins and matrices that lay down that form the scar.
So gliosis does not result in astrocytic death. Is that a fair statement?
No. Actually, gliosis results in increased astrocytes.
And can death itself affect what you see in astrocytes?
Death itself.
The process of dying. If, God forbid, I walk out after today's testimony and I'm crossing 15th Street and I'm hit by a bus, is the fact that I'm hit by a bus and then I unfortunately die, could that affect what you see?
Oh, absolutely.
Astrocytes?
I mean, if you're hit by the bus, you fall and your head hits the pavement, I mean, that's going to cause dramatic trauma to the brain. And again, depending on if you're not killed, I don't want to kill you, but say you're killed instantly and they take your brain out within a matter of an hour. I don't know why they would take your brain out, but let's just say that, for example. You may see, inflammatory responses occurring. Say they put you on a respirator, or say that you were in the hospital after this head trauma for 3 days before you died. If they took your brain out at that time, you would see massive, probably, microglial activation and astrogliosis as well associated with the damage. So the time between an insult and the cell death and a time between when you're looking at the brain is very, very critical, I think, yes.
And in animal studies, can the manner in which the animal is sacrificed affect what you see in the brain?
Yeah, again, it very much so. You have to be very careful in how you handle and how you harvest tissues in animals to make sure that you're not causing effects in the brains of animals or whatever you're studying that are due to the way that you knock the animals out and harvest the tissues and prepare the tissues. And that because you don't want to generate an effect that is what is something that you're looking for, but it is due to, an artifact of your preparation.
Now, if astrocytes are failing to reuptake glutamate, what are the short-term and long-term effects?
Well, the short-term effects of not reuptaking glutamate are probably you're going to have an excitatory amino acid. Your glutamate is going to increase in the synapse. It's going to be binding to the receptors, and the neuron that's on the postsynaptic side is going to be going to be hyperactive. In the long term, what's going to happen with increased glutamate excitation is the neurons are going to die. In fact, in vitro and in vivo, there are very well-established models using glutamate and glutamate agonists to basically kill neurons.
Now, if you see a significant long-term decrease in astrocytes, what would you expect to happen to neurons?
They would die.
And what if instead of dying, astrocytes were dysfunctional? What would you expect to happen to neurons?
They would die.
And if this was chronic dysfunction?
They would die.
And in your study of neurodegenerative diseases, once you see symptoms, what happens?
Well, once you see physical symptoms of somebody having neurodegenerative disease, they basically, the disease progresses and you get neuronal cell death in the region where, like for example, Alzheimer's or whatever, in the region where the cells are stressed, that propagates and expands to include the whole brain and eventually kills all this, kills the cells and you die.
And is there ever a plateau?
No.
So does it make sense for Dr. Kinsborn to say that there's chronic steady-state cell disruption via the astrocytes without leading progressive disease and cell death?
No.
So overall, based on your clinical experience and your research and your knowledge of the reports in the literature relating to your area of expertise, what is your conclusion regarding Dr. Dietz's hypothesis on this case?
That's not valid.
And what is your opinion about Dr. Kinsborn's hypothesis involving the astrocytes and neuroinflammation?
Well, the astrocytes and neuroinflammation, but I mean that, how that affects, it's not valid with regard to autism.
Now, you hold these opinions to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty?
Yes.
I have nothing further.
Mr. Williams, do you have any questions for this witness?
I want to find out first, are you disagreeing with the folks at Johns Hopkins and elsewhere that think that autism is, at least some autistic people have neuroinflammation as the primary underlying disease process?
I object to that term. And it's not part of the
I'd like to hear the witness.
Well, did you understand the question?
Yes, sir, I did.
No, I was asking the witness.
He needs to restate it, I think, for me.
What is your understanding of the role of neuroinflammation in autism?
I don't think neuroinflammation contributes to autism.
You don't?
No.
Did you say triggers or produces?
Doesn't contribute to it.
Doesn't contribute, okay.
I think if it doesn't, that's just my opinion.
And have you reviewed the autopsy studies on the autistic brain?
Which ones are you referring to?
Lopez Hurtado, for example.
I looked at it. I didn't review it.
In the autopsy studies, as well as in the adult monkey studies and the infant monkey studies, they had controls who were also sacrificed or killed by drowning or trauma, right?
Oh, I'm not questioning that. I just made a general comment about harvesting tissues. I wasn't specifically referring to any study.
So you're not criticizing the autopsy studies that have found differences in the brains of autistics versus controls? Let's stop there.
I've never done autistic versus control comparisons on postmortem tissues. You can look at the papers, but I really can't. It's really not what I do. So, I mean, my focus is mainly neurodegenerative diseases, and we really don't look at autism per se. So all I'm saying is that the neuroinflammation that's the hypothesized neuroinflammation, the neuroinflammation in neurodegenerative diseases is clearly leads to pathogenic processes that progress cell death and eventual patient death.
Okay, and I'll get to that in a minute. But what I'm trying to find out now is this: when you're talking about the trauma of death leading to brain damage that could, make it more difficult to see what was going on, isn't using controls a way to handle that problem?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
You have to have age match controls and controls that have the same postmortem time and things like that. Sure.
And that's also true of the monkey study. Right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Any study has to have controls. If you don't have controls, it's not a study.
Now, one question about the monkey studies. I don't want to throw them up here because we spent a lot of time the other day when Dr. Brent was testifying. And that may have been yesterday. We saw levels of inorganic mercury in the brain of the adult monkeys as low as 100 parts per billion, 100 nanograms per milliliter.
I don't work on the mercury. I don't work on mercury stuff. So, I don't think wanna.
Well, but you were saying that you thought that.
Let me just clarify. The only reason I looked at those papers was to get a what they said in those papers was the dose of mercury in the brains or the level of mercury in the brain, so that I could compare it to the in vitro studies. That's all I looked at that for. I didn't look at it to interpret other data.
But you expressed your surprise that Dr. Deeth could get results in the nanomolar range when you thought everybody else was only getting results in the micromolar.
That's all in vitro studies, yes. I mean, to have that kind of a differential in an in vitro study, as I've already stated, when people are using the exact same cell lines I've never seen that big of a differential before. So that's all I was saying. It had nothing to do with the mercury in the primates.
But the in vivo studies that we looked at, these adult monkey studies, they were getting activated microglia and astrocyte death in the nanomolar range, weren't they?
I disagree. We just talked about this astrocyte death. Probably their astrocytic death is probably not occurring in this process.
It's not occurring in the adult monkey studies?
I don't recall. I mean, what adult monkey studies are you referring to?
I'm referring to the five studies that came out of the mid-90s.
Those seemed irrelevant to me as far as what we're talking about today. So I really didn't. I really didn't focus on analyzing that data.
Let's look at one of the autopsy studies on autistics, if we could. This will be petitioner's master reference list 446, and I've got a copy to give. Oh, I've got it. Yeah. Is that one of the papers that you looked at?
I glanced at it, I think, while it was being discussed in court.
Okay. We've blown up the title there. It's called a Microscopic Study of Language-Related Cortex in Autism.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just briefly show you the abstract here. You can pull that up. And in the, they were looking at three different brain areas here that they had hypothesized might be related to some of the symptoms of autism. And without worrying about that problem, what I wanted to show you is where they talk about the density of glial cells. It's in about the middle of the abstract. It says the mean density of glial cells. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. right, Scott. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
The density of glial cells was greater. The density of neurons was lesser in autism area 22 and another area of the brain. And then they also found greater numbers of lipofuscin-containing cells. Now, do you know what lipofuscin is?
It's some kind of deposits in neurons, I think. It occurs with aging.
And they say the results are consistent with accelerated neuronal death in association with gliosis. And they go on to say that production of lipofuscin is accelerated, which is a matrix of oxidized lipid and cross-linked protein more commonly associated with neurodegenerative disease. And that's accelerated under conditions of oxidative stress. Now, if there's chronic neural inflammation in the brains of autistic patients, wouldn't that lead to oxidative stress in their brains?
Well, I mean, you're asking me a question. I haven't looked at the paper. I as a scientist, don't read an abstract and make conclusions based on data in the papers.
Can you say that again?
I said I cannot just look at a statement in an abstract of a paper and make any conclusions based on what's being done. I mean, I would have to read the whole paper and come back with a critical evaluation of the paper, but I'm not going to comment on some highlighted section of a text where I'm asked to make an opinion on that, and I have no background for it. I mean, that's just my I just don't do that.
Well, I understand that, but you didn't read this before you came in, to even though you were going to discuss neurodegeneration in the brains of autistics.
No, I wasn't discussing neurodegeneration in the brains of autistics. I was talking about neurodegeneration and what we study. I was just saying that the autistic patients don't have that same don't have the end result where in chronic neuroinflammation and chronic astrocytic microglial activation, you have progression, neuronal cell death, and eventual death of the patients. I mean, I've seen the word plateau used in almost all the time in the autistic patients' plateau. That doesn't happen in a chronic neuroinflammatory disease or a neurodegenerative disease that I study. All the time, you see chronic inflammation or you see astrocytic activation, microglial activation, neuronal cell death progresses to death of the patient.
Have you ever looked at the lifespan of autistic people the same as normal people?
I have no idea.
You have no idea?
Well, I mean, how long do autistic patients live?
Yeah, that's my question.
I don't know.
You never looked at that?
No. I have no reason. I don't study autism.
Are you aware that the Johns Hopkins group that has published some of these papers we've looked at, Dr. Vargas and Dr. Zimmerman and others, that they've actually applied for grants to find therapies to treat neuroinflammation as a way to try to treat autism?
No.
Do you think that that's a silly idea because neuroinflammation can't explain autism?
I mean, I really can't comment on that. I'd have to review the grant. I mean, and see what their preliminary data say. As we talked about this earlier, as a study section member, what you do is you look at the hypothesis, you critically evaluate the preliminary data and see if the experimental design justifies, you know, the funding of the grant. So I really can't, again, I mean, you're asking me to comment on things when I don't have the background or the understanding of what their proposal is actually trying to do.
Okay. Let me ask you one question about the Berman mouse study. One difference that I understood they used in their methods compared to what Dr. Horning's group had done is that they randomized the mice to treatment or non-treatment with thimerosal within a litter, as opposed to having, like as Horning did, have the entire litter treated or having the entire litter untreated. And they knew they were taking a risk of cross-contamination because they said in the paper they had done a pilot study to see if there was a problem with cross-contamination. Do you know why they decided to take that risk?
Explain what you mean by risk of cross-contamination.
Don't mice eat each other's feces when they're young?
You need to explain that to me a little bit better because it's very standard practice to avoid bias by randomizing puppies in different litters for your studies.
And you were lost in the middle of that sentence.
It's very common practice to randomize your litters so that you avoid litter bias in your experiments. And so what I mean by that is if I'm doing an experiment in my lab, what we would do is if we're going to treat with two different things, let's say, like vehicle and something else. If we need 10 animals, we'll take one animal from each litter, different litters, and make that one group, and then take an individual animal from another animal from the 10 litters and make that a different group. So the randomization is actually a way to avoid bias in experimental design, and that's actually, I think, a very positive thing.
But if you know, I mean, we've had testimony that thimerosal is, ethyl mercury is primarily excreted in the feces, not the urine, and that's true in the animals. If that's true, and if it's also true that young mice eat each other's feces, isn't that a risk of cross-contamination in a thimerosal experiment?
Well, I mean, my understanding of randomization is that you randomize the litters and then you do the dosing. So you don't mix the groups together like in one cage that have been treated with one thing or the other. For one thing, you don't do that. I mean, so it's that's not what they. My understanding of what they did is they randomized litters for treatment. They didn't mix the litters together. I think you're misinterpreting what's being said in the paper. I really do. I think that's being cautious. So the problem, and let's go back to the Horning paper, if what you said is true, is where if they take all of one litter and they treat that with something, and they take all of another litter and they treat that with something, then what you could have is you could have a differential between the two litters that are litter bias that has nothing to do with your treatment. And so that's why you do the litter randomization. It makes perfect scientific sense to do litter randomization so that you don't bias yourself in interpretation data. If there's something wrong with the one litter, say the mom's not nursing as much, I mean, you're going to cause stress in the animal that could bias your litter. So if that whole litter is biased because they're not nursing as well, it's very standard scientific protocol to randomize your litters. So I think you should probably look at that.
Randomize within litters, you mean?
No, randomize across litters. Yeah, because
let's just make sure we're understanding each other. Because what I understood the Berman paper to do was that they took, say there were eight pups in the litter, mm-hmm. and they injected four of those pups
right.
with thimerosal
right.
and four not, right? But they knew they were taking a risk of cross-contamination because they went to do this pilot study to check.
I think that what they're controlling there for is litter bias, and I think that's much more important than what you're trying to infer from this. So if you're trying to control for different responses in different litters by doing it that way, and I agree with that 100%.
Why couldn't, I mean, it's not that expensive to do mice, why couldn't they do the experiment both ways and see if it makes a difference?
Well, I mean, I can't tell you why they didn't do that, but I'm just saying that the way that it was done, at least the way that you're describing it to me, sounds like pretty good standard design experiments.
I want to ask you the question about inorganic mercury in neurons. Is that good, bad, or ugly?
Good, bad, or ugly if it's inorganic mercury in neurons?
Yeah.
Like I said, I mean, I really don't feel comfortable commenting a lot on mercury because we really don't work with mercury, and I'm more interested in the oxidative stress components and the pathologic process that we see in the disease. From a toxicology standpoint, I would say it probably isn't good. It probably isn't good having inorganic mercury anywhere.
Right. That's all I have. Thanks.
Please go ahead.
Now, on your cross, they put up the Lopez-Hurtado paper, and I am not going to ask you to comment specifically on the results. We know it's not something you're comfortable doing, but we did note that what was highlighted there noted neuronal loss.
Right.
And you saw that line that they highlighted.
Right.
Assuming that these results are correct, is that consistent with what Dr. Kinsborn has hypothesized about steady state of astrocyte death and dysfunction without progressive disease process?
No.
Nothing further.
Any questions for this witness? Mr. Williams, anything further for this witness? All right. Dr. Johnson, we're done with you. Thank you very much. Well, counsel, it's unexpectedly early in the day.
Not to us.
You have any more witnesses you plan to call today for the government?
Yes, sir.
All right. Let me raise an issue, then while we're here, we had talked last week about Respondent's Exhibit LL, the Pardo.
Yes, sir.
And we had talked about where we needed to talk further about that.
That's correct,
that exhibit.
I can tell you right now that Dr. Pardo, as my last information was that he is not in the country till the 21st, so I have not been able to inquire of him any further about whether he'd be available to answer questions, written questions, whether he'd be available to come and testify. I know that at my last conversation with him, he was not willing to testify, and I haven't been able to have a conversation with him since then, since he's been out of the country. I know we discussed some other matters, perhaps, that might help with respect to further seeing his views, and I frankly would be anxious if that was possible, if he'd be willing to have those further views in front of the court, because I think they expand upon...
Speak up.
I'm sorry. I think they expand upon and, in fact, make even more apparent the limitations he believes that can be placed upon his work, at least for the interpretations under which the interpretations that are, or extrapolations that are being drawn from it by the petitioners right now. But I have not been able to speak to him since before the trial, before I even received a letter from him. And I understand that he's not back in this country until I believe the 21st.
Of this month.
Which is tomorrow.
Tomorrow. So you hope to have a chance to talk with him tomorrow?
I'm not sure when he gets back in the country tomorrow. That was the date I was given. But yes, as soon as he came back, we were hoping to get in touch with him to discuss whether he'd be available in some fashion to elaborate on the comments that he had in his letter.
And if I recall correctly, the petitioners, when the respondent filed Exhibit LL, Mr. Powers, your response to it was that we would like to cross-examine him.
Yes, Special Master. And the letter actually turned out to be something a little bit different than what I had expected to see. My understanding initially was that this was something that was being given by Dr. Pardo to respondent. And when one looks at the letter, it's a letter from Dr. Pardo. It's correspondence between Dr. Kemper and Dr. Pardo. So I was thinking that it would be something akin to an expert report or commentary that would resemble an expert report that would be given to respondent and be filed in. But it's correspondence between non-parties here. So to that extent, we're prepared to use that letter and cross-examination of witnesses, since it's been filed in the case, to explore the areas that are raised in there. So we're prepared to use it in cross-examination. On the other hand, if there is any, and it sounds as if with Mr. Matanowski's further characterization of what Dr. Pardo might believe, if this is going to be a surrogate for an expert report that they're relying on, then we certainly would want to cross-examine. And we completely understand that in the program, an expert report, for example, can be submitted and no cross-examination is had. But what we see in this case is nothing that even resembles an expert report at this point.
Well, we frequently consider letters, do we not? For example, a letter from one expert physician to the primary care physician saying, I think X and this is why I think it. And you submit those as exhibits all the time.
Correct. And that's why I'm saying that if this is correspondence, then yeah, you take it at face value, cross-examine to explore the underlying basis for what's being said and the context in which it's emerged, and we're totally prepared to do that. All I'm saying is that if this letter is something that is eventually going to be reduced to a form, like an expert report stating an opinion, being filed on behalf of the respondent in support of their case, then we would want an opportunity to cross-examine Dr. Pardo. But at this point, it looks like a letter, like any other correspondence that might come in, and we're prepared to use it in cross-examination at this point.
The letter is obviously, it was written to one of our witnesses, and as such, I think it then begins, I agree with Mr. Powers, he can cross-examine the witness as to those matters. The letter gives him a little bit of a heads up of what Dr. Pardo has relayed to Dr. Kemper. So I expect we are going to hear some things from Dr. Kemper about what Dr. Pardo and his colleagues have found in those autopsy studies. The letter is not submitted as an expert report. Dr. Pardo is explaining what his study, he's almost like a fact witness, if you will. He's explaining his study has been looked at and relied on heavily by the petitioners at this point. And he's trying to, he's seen that that it's been relied on by them, and he's trying to explain the limits that one can place on his work, at least as far as the interpretations or extrapolations therefrom. We saw something similar in the last trial when Dr. Oldstone's work was being characterized in a certain fashion by witnesses, and Dr. Oldstone came in and said, these are the limits of what I think you can take from my work. And I think that's what Dr. Pardo, up to this point at least, with respect to the correspondence, has done in this case.
With that understanding of what the government's purpose in introducing the letter, are you comfortable, Mr. Powers, with its admittance?
Certainly, Special Master, as I said, just on its face right now, we're comfortable with it being in the record, and we're completely prepared to use it in cross-examination and explore the issues that are raised in that letter.
Let's take a 5-minute break here, and I want to confer with my colleagues about scheduling very briefly, and then we'll get back and presumably we'll be done for the day. We'll make a plan for tomorrow, but yeah, let's take a 5-minute break here.
Excuse me, Special Masters.
Oh yeah.
Excuse me, Vince.
Mr. Manmaster.
One time, very good. Thank you.